just watching the sunrise, watching the geese fly so low over your head, you know, having a duck quack right behind you, I have no idea you're there. Just nature, just the woods waking up around you and not realizing that you're right there.
Can I tell you something?
Just stop for a minute. Is that great or what? Is that great? Just listening to nothing.
No.
A little bit of wind coming through. And every once in a while you hear, ch ch ch. You think it's a deer, it might be a squirrel, it could be anything.
I just love it out there. I mean, I love it.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
It's slowly getting warmer. The sun is showing up more and more often, both in my home country of Germany, as far as I can tell from over here anyway, and here in Philadelphia, where I've been for the past couple of months. But just a few weeks ago, I went into the snow again. I drove 5 hours north into the state of New York, and while what little snow we've had here in Philly had long since melted, I now suddenly found myself in a cold, white winter wonderland. So that was nice, but what was especially nice was that I met up with a former Unfolding Maps guest there again to record another episode with him, Eric Adams, the singer of the legendary American heavy metal band Manowar. Maybe you remember. Eric and me talked about his love of nature, wildlife, and also hunting in episode 16 of Unfolding Maps, which was a re-release of an older episode I had done with him for my German podcast show, Weltwach. In that episode, Eric told me how his father first showed him the wilderness, he recalled some of his most memorable hunting experiences, and he talked about the quiet magic of a dawning day in the forest. He also explained in detail what he understands as ethical and responsible hunting. If you haven't listened to that episode 16 yet, I recommend doing that first before turning your attention to this episode right here. Yes, and recently, as I have already mentioned, we continued our conversation, not like last time in Germany, shortly before a Manowar concert, but in this case in Eric's American hometown. First, we talked in my hotel, and then we went out into the densely falling snow, where Eric showed me his hunting grounds for a day. You can hear all of that, or an excerpt of it, in this episode. Accordingly, Eric and me will talk about hunting once more, and I am aware that this is not everyone's cup of tea. It is a topic that many people have strong opinions about. So, as with the last episode with Eric, my suggestion is to listen how he thinks and talks about it, then form an opinion, and then you can agree or disagree with him. Both are, of course, legitimate. What I promise you is this. You will not only learn something about ethical hunting and about the animal world of New York, and for the music fans amongst you, of course, there'll also be one or the other Manowar story, but you will also hopefully have a lot of fun. In any case, I laughed tears at some points during the post-production of this episode and also during the interview itself, especially at two stories Eric tells towards the end of the episode. So be sure to stay tuned. It's really worth it. Eric is just an insanely funny and likable person, and he is indeed an absolute legend in the rock and heavy metal scene. And that is exactly my music. He's been on the road with Manowar for over 40 years now. They've sold well over 20 million albums, collaborated with giants like Orson Welles or Christopher Lee. They play shows in front of tens of thousands of fans. And for all these reasons, it was a particularly outstanding privilege for me to join Eric for a day. So have fun and please enjoy the episode. Here we go. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the podcast.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much for making the time for a second round.
No, I got to thank you, Eric, for making the trip up to my hometown here. This is Manowar land up here, okay?
The land of the Vikings.
It's land of the Vikings and it's cold. Yes.
Yes, it's my absolute pleasure, especially since the first interview we did got a pretty good response, I have to tell you. I don't know if, did you ever listen to it?
Actually? I did. I listened to the whole thing. Oh, wow. And I read some of the responses. And I'm glad. Hey, I'm glad that the fans all loved it. I really am. I'm glad that they learn a little bit more about, you know, what hunting is for me. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is, everybody's different, but this is my perspective on hunting.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's also the response that I got through emails and so on, that people were, I mean, not all of them that listened to the show, of course, knew Manowar before.
Right.
So it's not like everybody was like, wow, Eric Adams talking about hunting. That's great. So they really listened because they were interested in what you had to say about the outdoors and about hunting.
Yeah.
And I think some of them who are not really into heavy metal, they were really surprised, first of all, how nice and friendly and kind and witty you were. So that was nice. And then as well, of course, the main feedback was relating to what we actually talked about, the outdoors, the hunting, and the appreciation that our listeners had for being educated a little bit more and for understanding more what it is really about, what it is not about.
Yeah.
But some people also wrote me that they felt you are so nice, so ethical, so thoughtful about it. Mm-hmm. They wondered if that is really like representative for what hunters are actually like, or if you are like a particularly ethical person that we listen to. What's your response to that?
My response to that is, you know, it's a big world out there. There's a lot of hunters out there, and one bad apple doesn't spoil the whole bunch. You know what I mean? There are bad apples out there. I'm not going to deny it. There are people that go on posted property without asking. There are people that shoot an animal, and if it's too small when they find it, I'm not going to take it and they leave it. And, you know, that to me is absolutely disgusting. And so when I teach the course, I teach the bow hunting course for Cayuga County, for New York.
Yeah, in the state of New York.
Yeah, in the state of New York. And part of it is ethics. I think we went over this last time. A lot of mine is ethics. And I start off the class with that. And I tell them, look, I'm not going to apologize for it. You're going to hear this word a lot.
Yeah.
Because it means that much to me. And, you know, I tell people that it's, you know, what's the ethical thing to do? And when, what is ethics to you? And some people say, well, it's, you know, doing the right thing. I said, that's part of it. That's part of it. But there's another part of it. And it's doing the right thing when no one's there to see you.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can be a little difficult. You know, if you're within shooting range of posted property and that big buck is, you know, standing on the posted property and he's not coming in to you, it takes an awful lot not to take a shot at that animal if you know you could get him. If he's on the posted property, that's just the way it is. That's part of the hunt. And if you can't bring him in to your land, you know, for an ethical hunt, then he lives, period. That's all there is. And that's part of the hunt. It's not, I say this in my class, the hunt is fooling the animal. You know, fooling his nose, which is really hard to do.
And we will get into some strategies on how you are doing that, which partly is very funny, but let's get to that later.
Fooling his nose and fooling his ears and fooling his eyesight, you know, and trying to get him within close range for a bow and arrow. And, you know, if you can't do that, then can't do it. But that's the hunt.
Yeah.
Once he's there and you've practiced and you draw your bow back and you know that you're accurate at this distance, that deer is dead as far as you're concerned. Now, you don't have to release that arrow. The hunt's over when you pull the arrow back and you've got him in your sights. That's it. The hunt's done. If you decide to let that arrow fly, then the work begins.
Mm.
Then the work begins. And it's two different things. And I try to tell the class that. There's a hunt and there's work, you know, that you have to follow through ethically. You've got to follow through on that. You get a lousy hit on a deer. If you get a bad hit on a deer, that's too bad. You did the shot. You're responsible to do everything you can to either take out that deer or at least do everything you can to find that deer.
Yeah.
If you can't find it, okay. If you did everything you could, okay. You know, coyotes have to eat too, you know, and that's the way I look at it. If you do everything you can do to find that animal, okay.
That's what you teach in the course you're teaching.
It's exactly what I teach. Yeah.
You also wrote a book recently. It's an audiobook.
I did. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. I did. Yeah. I wrote an audiobook.
And by the way, it has the best title ever. As far as I'm concerned, it's about bow hunting.
Yeah.
And the title is String Theory for Bow Hunters.
Yeah.
So that is pretty cool. How did you come up with that title?
You know, I was tossing around ideas back and forth, and my son, Eric, gave me the title. He said, why don't you do the string theory for bow hunting? And he was laughing about it. And we all laughed about it. And I said, yeah, that's funny. And I said, well, you know what? that's not too bad. That's okay. And so that's what I used.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah. And one little quote from that book is the following. It relates to what we're talking about right now. Years ago, I thought a successful hunt means killing a deer or the animal of your choice. Mm-hmm. So that was what you thought yourself a long time ago.
Right.
And right now, we already talked about how you think today. We also talked about that last time.
Yeah.
But we didn't talk about what was it that made you change your mind, how you thought about what a hunt is about.
I think just being out there the years that I've hunted and seeing what I see in the woods. You know, just this past season, Eric, I was in my tree stand and I went there very early, well before it got daylight. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in my tree stand and you'll see that stand today. We'll walk right by it.
Okay.
And, I took a picture as the sunrise was coming up. I took a picture and I posted that picture of sunrise coming up in the woods. But before that ever happened, I hit a big bird. I could see the silhouette of a big bird fly in and it landed from me to you away, really, that close, landed in a tree right there. And I says, what is this bird? You know, like, you know, I could think maybe it's a hawk and I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
But it was there and I'm thinking, this bird would think I'm food and come flying at me with his talons and that's not too cool. So I had my flashlight.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell what it was. I took my flashlight out and I turned my flashlight on the bird and it was an owl looking at me.
Wow.
And it was just, and I'm sorry I didn't take a picture of it because it was the most beautiful owl you've ever seen that close. And my flashlight made it like a spotlight around it, you know, and it was so cool. And I just said, get out of here.
Why were you worried?
I didn't want it to think it kept looking at me, you know, kept looking at me. And it was still dark out. And I'm thinking, he's looking for dinner. He's looking for breakfast and I don't want him flying at me. So get out of here. And, I'm sorry I didn't take a picture of him, but oh well.
So how does this experience and similar experiences relate to how you started to think differently?
I just started to think that, you know, there's so much happening in the woods that this is what it's all about. You know, it is what it's all about. And the anticipation of shooting a nice big deer, that's the hunt. And I realized that when I had smaller deer come up and I'd let them walk through, I said, I'm not taking you today. And I let them walk through.
And you were just as happy about the day.
No. Just, I had one of my best hunts I ever had, Eric, was, I had seven different bucks all around me. All at the same time. And I was amazed. I've never had that happen. I don't know if it'll ever happen again, but they were all year and a half old deer that were, you know, they were legal to take. They were, you know, 6-point bucks, which means three on each side, three antlers on each side and three antlers. And, they were 6-pointers and 4-pointers. And I'm not going to take a deer that young. I'm not going to do it. So I let them walk, but it was interesting watching them. I had one very, very close to me feeding and I had no idea that he could have had a bad day. He had no idea, but he was there and I'm watching him and I enjoyed it. It was such a great hunt. That's when you realize, man, that's the hunt. That's the hunt. Just watching the sunrise, watching the geese fly so low over your head, you know, that's the hunt. I having a duck quack right behind you. I have no idea you're there. You know, just nature, just the woods waking up around you and not realizing that you're right there. That's the hunt, you know?
Fitting right in some sense, right?
Yeah, and you can't do that in your living room. You know, you can't do that in your living room. I've tried. Get dressed up in my camouflage and I sit there. I don't see any deer, okay? It's just the way it is. It's warmer, though. It is a lot warmer.
It is, yes. We will find that out today, I think, head out there. It's pretty snowy and really, really cold right now. I can see it through the window.
Yes, it's about 20 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's pretty cold.
Yeah. In your book, you actually illustrate this change that you went through with a pretty descriptive story and also, in some sense, funny story. I don't know if you already know what I'm hinting at. It is about you and some friends driving through the city of Ithaca, which is close to you, with all its traffic lights.
True story.
Would you mind telling the story? And then we can discuss afterwards what you learned from that.
Not at all. It was Ithaca. First, let me make this point for the people that don't have my book. You should get it, by the way. It is really funny.
And if I may point out, not only if you're into bow hunting, because I'm not, but it's really, really entertaining as well. Of course, there are some chapters that are very theoretical and technical.
But
there's also a lot of stories about funny mishaps, a lot of stories with like recipes. And it's just an entertaining listen.
Can I tell you something? That was the best chapter in that book was the funny stories, I think. I mean, they're all true. That's what makes it funny. They're true. They really happen.
Maybe we will listen to one of them later on.
That's funny.
We don't want to give everything away, of course, but maybe a little teaser. And when you're reading this in the audiobook, by the way, it was a very great pleasure for me to listen to it, because you can actually hear that while reading them in the studio, you had to laugh yourself about just the memories.
Because I start thinking about it, you know. You can't get that when you're reading the book. You got to listen to it.
Okay.
So let me tell you, this Ithaca hunt, down the main street of the city, there's so many traffic lights. Every intersection has a traffic light. It's ridiculous, right? And it takes forever to get through that city. So after a hunt one day, we had a great day. It was one of those days where all of us, we all scored on a deer, or most of us did. And at the time, the person that was driving used to put what we call a sandbox up on top of his vehicle. And it was like a square wooden box up there. And we just put
like
the deer.
Like an open box. Like an open box. Top, kind of. Yeah.
And we would put the deer up on top of there all the time. This is before anybody drove with trucks and trailers or anything else. It was just a big SUV that we threw the deer up on top of, you know. And at that day, we had four different deer up on top of that vehicle. And that's a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of extra weight. And I didn't care because it wasn't my vehicle. But boy, that was a lot of weight. And we're starting to drive back home through the city of Ithaca. And we're talking and laughing and shooting the breeze. We're having such a great time talking about the hunt we had. And I looked up and I saw that the light was changing to red. And the driver wasn't paying attention. He was, you know, listening to our stories. And I said, red light. And the guy slammed on his brakes. And all the blood that had gathered from the four deer up on top of his vehicle, all the blood just swooshed down on this windshield. And we laughed. Oh, man. We laughed hard. I mean, it was like, oh, all of us guys were laughing.
And just then, a really bloody mess.
Oh, it was a mess. The guy, it was all over. You couldn't see. The whole windshield was covered with blood. And so the guy immediately turned his windshield wiper on. And when the wiper wiped the window off, it blew all the blood on the vehicle next to us. It was parked at the red light as well. And it was a white car. And I'm looking at it, and we all laughed. Oh, my God. Because it just was like somebody taking a bucket of red paint and throwing it on the vehicle. It was like, and we laughed. We couldn't stop laughing. We really couldn't stop. We were laughing so hard, looking at it. And I looked and I saw the look on everybody's face in that car. They looked at us like we were terrible. What's wrong with you people?
Total maniacs.
They were on their way to, it was a Sunday. They were on their way to church on that Sunday. There was a family of four. I remember it was a wife, a husband, two kids in the back seat who were looking up at Rudolph dead up in the, on our vehicle.
So first of all, they saw all the dead animals, all these dead heads whipping in the air probably. Then all this blood, probably they were really traumatized.
They were traumatized. There wasn't a question about it. I mean, the look on their faces, they were crying. I mean, the blood was spattered all over their white car, and they had to either miss church or go to a car wash or whatever they were going to do. But we laughed and laughed and couldn't stop laughing. And then when the light changed, we continued home. And I realized at that time, man, we should have – that was bad. And I thought about it.
Pretty ignorant, actually.
It was terrible. I said we should have. And I said something at the time in the car. We should have asked those people if they wanted a car wash, apologized to them. But – you know, it wasn't going to happen. We were laughing too hard. We couldn't stop, you know. And we were tired, you know. You're tired and you're punchy. You start laughing over everything, you know. Yeah. But, I went to school on that. I learned something there. You got to be a little more careful of how you act in the public.
How important is it for you how you present yourself in the public as a hunter?
It's huge. It's huge because, you know, not everybody understands hunting, number one. And, you know, they all say, if you want meat, you can go to the grocery store and get it. Mm. You know, they don't understand that we love nature. We love being out there in the woods. And if we're fortunate enough to take an animal that we're going to bring home and eat, you know, then it's a whole different ball game. And there's so many people that don't get that. Statistics tell us that only 10% of the whole United States are hunters. 10%. You wouldn't realize that because some states have no hunters at all, little few hunters. States like Texas, mm-hmm. tons of hunters. But only about 10% of the people are hunters. And 10% of the people are anti-hunters. Now, anti-hunters are the people that absolutely do not want you in the woods. They do not understand how you could kill that poor animal. What did he ever do to you? How can you do that to an animal? And okay, they don't get it. They don't get it.
How do you think about anti-hunters? Are they in your world, in your mind, like the enemy? Or are they just stupid? Are they not getting it? Or do you think they also have a valid point? It's just a different opinion.
Yeah, they just have an opinion. They don't understand it. That's the thing. And in the moment, if some anti-hunter comes to you and takes down your tree stand or something, or stands in front of you while you're trying to hunt and, you know, urinates, you know, next to your stand and it's going to scare the deer away or whatever, you know, you start looking at that and you're saying, these people, you can't have a conversation with anybody like that at that point. But if you're in a bar and you're talking to somebody about it and they bring up, you know, their opinions, and it is an opinion, and I have an opinion too. I try to explain to them what I'm telling you right now, that look, it's not about hunting animals. It's a lot of it's about learning the woods, learning what nature has to offer out there that you can't find unless you walk through the woods. And do I get upset when I see someone hiking through the woods while I'm hunting? Absolutely not. It's when they stop and start complaining to me, what are you doing out here? I could do the same to them. Mm-hmm. What are you doing out here during hunting season? Are you not aware that there's arrows here and there's people trying to hunt? You know, I'm not, they have a right to be in the woods, and so do I. So I have no complaint over that at all. They just don't know. They don't understand what hunting's all about. So I'm not upset over that. I really am not.
And you just said hunting is about nature. We talked about it. Yeah. And hunting is also about conservation, right? Which when I prepared for this, I found out, and I didn't know that before, that even if you don't like hunters, actually their licenses and the money they pay to be able to hunt, they very often fund the state's wildlife apparatus, like protecting habitats, disease control, reintroducing populations. So all of this kind of conservation work is, in part at least, to my understanding, also done with the money that comes in through hunting.
Yeah, Pittman-Robinson Act is called at the time. And this was decades ago when this came into play. And what happens is, everything that we buy for hunting, be it license, any weapons that we might buy, ammunition, arrows, broadheads, camouflage, anything you buy that relates to hunting, part of that goes to this fund, conservation fund. And that is to take care of the wildlife. A good example of that, which is not far from here, is Montezuma National Game Reserve. It's not far at all from here. It's about maybe 10, 12 miles from here. And it's a place where deer, waterfowl, and beavers, and any wild animal can go in there, and we make sure that it has the habitat that it needs to survive. You know, even during the rough winters, and we have some rough winters up here, we make sure that they have food to survive and water that they need to survive. And it's working. It's been there for a long, long time. And the hunters have paid for this, you know, through the Pittman-Robinson Act. And so that's important. People don't realize that. Somebody who goes to Walmart and buys buys anything in Walmart, their money doesn't go towards that.
And also keeping overpopulation under control. Of course, it's the same thing. It's also kind of helping conservation by preventing spread of a disease.
We have an issue right now near Ithaca, where I hunted before, where there's just too many deer. And when it gets to be too many deer, that's a problem for you and I, because every year, if people can understand this, every year a doe will have two fawns. It's very common to have two fawns every year. Sometimes they have more.
What is a fawn? I don't know.
A fawn is a baby deer.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. They'll have two fawns every year. So if nobody shoots the does, then that population rises really quick, really quick. And a deer has to have 5 pounds of wet browse to survive every day. Now that's a lot. That's a lot. So what that means is, as the population, the deer population rises, well, they have to eat. They have to have food to eat. And they're going into cities and towns and they're eating the brush of people's front lawn. Mm-hmm. That's very common. People complaining, well, the deer are eating my flowers. They're eating these bushes that I planted years ago. Well, okay. You can do something about it and let people hunt the property near you and take care of those deer, or you could let them eat your property. And not only that, but it's just that when there's so many deer, especially during the mating season, bucks are chasing does. They're crossing roads. They're causing car accidents. They're causing human death. It's bad. It's a bad thing. And I'll show you a video that I received yesterday. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine sent me a video of elk that crossed the road. And it didn't get hit. Cars didn't hit it. But you should see this video. It came really close.
Okay. That's scary.
Yeah, it is scary. It is scary. Nothing you can do about it. That's nature. That's nature. And when it gets to be overpopulated, it gets to be dangerous.
You are promoting ethical hunting behavior in your area. We talked about it.
Yep.
And conservation as well. And
yep.
You are a lover of the outdoors, of
I
the
am.
Beauty of nature. How do you think about global developments such as climate change on the mass extinction of species and so on? Do you follow these developments as well?
I do.
Do you worry about them?
I do, and I do worry about it. Normally, well, I say 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would have snow up here in October. Maybe it was long, maybe 20 years ago. We had snow up here in October. And that was good during the deer season because you could see the silhouette of the deer against the snow.
Mm-hmm.
And you could also see the tracks of the deer in the woods. So if you're following deer, you have no problem with it. You can just follow the tracks and, you know, wait till you get your comfortable shot. But lately, every deer season, there's no snow now. So it's warming up. It's definitely warming up. And people that say, oh, climate change isn't really, it's not real, it's not happening. They're not educated enough to understand what's going on, because I fear for the people that live in the coastal areas. When change happens that fast and the icebergs start to melt, it sounds like, oh, that's way far away. It's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. But it is a big worry, because now I can see the climate change within 10 or 15 years. I see it, and I'm not alone. There's a lot of people.
And you're not living at the coastlines. You're not living in the Arctic. You're not
right.
Living in a place where you would think that this is the first place that's going to be hit. You're living in the middle of Northern America.
Exactly.
And it's happening right here as well.
Right here. And here's a good example of it. This week, it's going to be almost 70 degrees. 70 degrees in March. I mean, that's unheard of up here.
Mm.
This is more like our weather, what we have today.
Yeah, I wanted to say today it's definitely not 70 degrees.
No, it's jumping up to 70 degrees, and it's going to be like that for 3 or 4 days. It's going to be like that. So all that snow is going to melt very quickly. It's going to go in the rivers and the streams. It's going to cause flooding. I mean, look what happened down in Texas just recently.
No.
I mean, it's unheard of to have that much snow in Texas. They're not used to this. They don't have the insulation that
That's
we have
That's why the power
here.
System broke down. Yeah.
Everything broke down. They had no heat. They had no water. They had no, you know, it was ridiculous. It was horrible. And then it flooded, and then it was bad. And then people, when the pipes break, the water's coming in the house, and it causes all kinds of issues for everybody. So, yeah, it's definitely a major problem, major problem that people have to address.
Well, today it is cold, and our meeting today, it was quite a while in the making.
Yeah.
We sent back and forth quite a few emails to try to make it happen, and there was one recurring theme in your emails to me, which was warnings, like, dress warm, Eric.
Dress.
Next email, Eric, it's going to be cold, !! Next email, Eric, please bring boots.
That's right.
Yesterday night when I was in my car on the way here, you even called me, Eric, did you bring gloves? Did you bring boots? It's going to be cold.
Well, I was asking you because I have stuff at home. I mean, I've got bins and bins of warm clothes. And, you know,
I appreciate the care, but I have to say it scared me a little bit. So I think I'm really ready. I'm wearing 4 packs of socks right now.
Yeah.
3 layers of pants.
You'll be all right. You'll
so
be all right.
I'm ready, but I'm also kind of getting warm right now. That's why I suggest, what about we're heading out?
We're
going to explore some of your hunting grounds, right?
Let's go, yeah. I'm going to put a camera out. I put cameras out in the woods.
Oh, like photo cameras.
The cameras out in the woods. I'll put it out there and I'll check it.
Yeah.
Maybe 3-4 months from now, I'll go there and
trying to catch some photos.
Just to see what deer are in the area, what coyotes we have in the area.
So it's like a kind of camera that is activated if there's movement?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'll just put it on a deer run that I know is there and I'll see if any deer work in that area. And if I see that there's a lot of action in that one area, I'll hunt that particular stand. I'll show you later today.
Sure.
We'll see it.
Looking forward to it. Okay.
All right.
Let's go. Thank you.
Good.
Do you mind me asking one or two questions, or is that too irritating while driving?
Do what you gotta do.
So, Eric, yesterday I drove about, I believe, 5 hours to get here.
Uh-huh.
And I just followed, I did whatever the navigation system told me,
right.
Because you told me to be here. So I don't really know that well where we actually are. I mean, of course, we don't want to know your personal address, but as far as you want to tell us, where are we right now? Where in America?
We are in New York State. And if you're looking at New York State, it's right in the center of the state. It's about 25 miles west of Syracuse, New York. And it's called the Finger Lakes area. And if you look from the air, it's called the Finger Lakes for a reason, because there's 5 or 6 different lakes there, and it looks like fingers floating down. I live on the second finger. Or near it. I don't live right on the lake, but I live near the second finger, yes.
This is where you live, and evidently that's where you hunt.
Yeah, this is where I live. I've lived here my whole life, and it's hard to leave this area because it's a rural area, a lot of it is, and the hunting is abundant. I don't have to travel very far. You'll see, it's not that far at all to the woods. And we'll go up to the lake, too, because we'll go right by the lake.
So when you're driving in your car like this, or when you're walking in the woods on your own, having a moment of, you know, quiet time, reflection, whatever, do you tend to, like, hum and sing songs to yourself to pass the time? And if so, what are you singing? Are you, like, Warriors of the World in the shower, or what is your music of choice for these situations?
It's funny. Funny you ask that. I rarely sing any Man of War songs, but I always am singing something. It's amazing to me. If I hear something on the radio, I can't get it out of my head. I'd be humming it throughout the day until my wife finally says to me, "Will you please stop? I'm trying to watch the show," and I don't even realize I'm doing it. I'm just, you know, could be a commercial with a song, a catchy tune or something on the commercial that I'm saying, "Oh yeah," and I'm just singing. I don't realize I'm doing it. You know, it's funny, really, really funny. I've had more than one person tell me that you hum all the time. Jeez, I don't know. Sorry.
So, I mean, for many musicians or bands that have had some success, especially with some songs, they also get tired of part of their music after years and years and decades of, especially if they have to sing the same songs.
Yeah.
You know, some bands, they're just, whatever, they can mix up their repertoire at each show and it's kind of keeps it fresh. How is it with you? I mean, of course, you have also some songs that are must-perform songs for each concert.
Yeah.
Do you get a little bit tired of some of them after all these years?
Well, to be honest,
we can still edit it out, but let's be honest for now.
To be honest, we've done, the first song of our set has always been Man of War. That's the very first song we've always done.
Yeah.
And
the opener to each show.
The opening set. And I said one time when we were rehearsing for a show, I said, you know, I am so tired of opening up with that same song over and over again. I said, come on, you know, let's open up with something else, you know, something else.
Just anything.
Anything. We picked, I can't remember the name of the song.
I know, A Call to Arms.
Call to Arms, thank you, yeah. We picked Call to Arms.
Yeah.
And we had a kabuki in front of us, which is a curtain in front of us. Mm-hmm. And it fell down during one hit in the song. And you know, it was timed to fall down at a certain time. And I thought, this is a great idea. Rehearsals, it was great. no problems, you know.
And it's a powerful song, a lot of energy immediately from the start.
Right away, it's great, you know. But the fans, they did not like it.
Really?
They did not like it. They wanted Man of War. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh my God, why would they want that over and over again? And Joey said to me.
Your band leader?
Yep. He said to me, that's because that's what they expect. He said, they're in the audience, they're waiting for the band to come out. For somebody who's never seen the band before, Joey would say, their friends are telling you, wait, they're going to come out. They're going to start this. They're going to come out with the Man of War, and Eric's going to come out from the side. He said, they know the whole show, you know.
And they don't want to be surprised.
And they don't want to be surprised. They want to see that, you know. So, okay, there you go. So...
This, as far as I can tell, what we are seeing right now is kind of quintessential small town America, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It really is. Yeah. You know, over where you're from, there's the houses are made of brick and this and that. There's a lot of homes here just made of wood, you can see. Yeah.
And, I mean, in these harsh weather conditions, I'm kind of worried for the people inside, but evidently it works well enough, right? They're not all freezing.
They're not home freezing. They're all insulated. The homes are insulated up here. And we get a lot of cold weather, and we're kind of used to it, you know. So,
do you like the cold weather, or are you more like suffering through it?
that's a great question. I like the cold weather. I like the snow. What I don't like is I'm going to go right in here just to show you. What I don't like is ice. Especially black ice. That's the ice you can't see. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the black ice, but you just can't see. It looks like a wet road, and all of a sudden you're sliding.
Yeah.
Man, it could be bad.
Didn't that happen to you once with a friend?
Yes, it did. That is in the book, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. So what happened there?
We spun around. We were just driving down Ithaca, and we spun around and just started doing 360s, spinning and spinning, and we had no control over it. And all we saw was white coming at us. And I had a cup of coffee with me. And I had a thermos of coffee, and I had the coffee in my hand. And we started spinning and spinning. I did my best to keep I thought I was great keeping that coffee where it had to go. And we ended up against the bank, you know. And when we finally stopped, and I looked at my buddy who was driving. He was covered. He was covered in coffee. It was all over him. My coffee cup was empty. I mean, and the coffee was all over.
Dripping.
Oh, it was everywhere. He just looked at me like, Jesus Christ. He says, holy shit, are you all right? I says, yeah, I'm fine.
Just the coffee is gone.
Oh, my God, it was funny. He said.
Probably in the first second you were quite pleased with yourself. Like, okay, I did well with the coffee.
Well, yeah, I thought I did great with it. And then he said to me, he said, Jesus Christ. He said, that coffee, when I traded the car in, I was still finding coffee stains all over the place. It was so funny.
This is a lake.
This is our lake up here. This is a Wasco Lake. And this building right here, when I was growing up, used to have dances, like lake dances, they called it. And I played at those. Man of War didn't play at that because it was already closed by that time. But in my early years, I used to play up here
Nice.
Some of the bands. Ronnie Dio did too.
Mm, wow.
Yeah, I talked to Ronnie.
In this little cute little wooden house here.
Yeah.
Wow.
For non-heavy metal fans, Ronnie Dio, who Eric is talking about here, was a hard rock and heavy metal singer in bands like Rainbow, Black Sabbath, Dio, and Heaven and Hell. And he was considered one of the most important rock singers and one of the pioneering personalities overall in this music genre. In 2010, unfortunately, he died of cancer.
Ronnie and I, last time I saw Ronnie, we talked about it. We talked about the lake dances and how he used to play with his band from Cortland, come up here and do these shows. And so, yeah, it was kind of fun.
Yeah, lots of memories.
Yeah. We played the same halls. We played the same clubs growing up. Ronnie grew up, you know, Cortland's about 35 miles south of here. So we grew up together, you know. I'm going to go by. You can kind of look at the lake as I'm going by here. And mm-hmm.
Wow, okay, that does look like a big lake. I can't even see. Can I see the end of it? Yeah,
no,
barely, right?
The end of it's about 18 miles south of here. They're long, narrow lakes, you know.
Do you ever go fishing on some of these lakes?
I do, yeah. Sometimes. I'm not that big of a fisherman, but I do something just for something to do in the summertime, you know. We fish for this particular lake has lake trout.
must be also so beautiful here in summer, right? I mean, now it's also very picturesque with all the snows, all the snow. But if I imagine all the trees being really full of a lush green, must be beautiful.
Oh, you know, it's everywhere. Yeah, it's really a gorgeous area to live. It really is. Taxes are ridiculous.
Other than that,
the taxes are bad. A lot of people leave New York State because of the taxes. But the area is beautiful. You know, like I said, you know, we take it for granted. I've been all over the world many times, and, you know, there's no place like home. I hate to sound that there is. There's no place like home.
Talking of the cold that we are right now surrounded by, I remember in our last conversation you told me that our last conversation was during your last tour, and you were looking forward to playing a show pretty far up in the north, in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah,
you were looking forward to that. You were even hoping to see some polar bears. Probably that didn't happen. But but how did the actual show end up going, and how was the experience for you to be that far up north?
Oh, the show was outstanding.
With my question, I refer to a concert Eric gave with Manowar in 2019 in Longyearbyen. And I'm sure I'm messing up the pronunciation completely. I'm not even going to try. In any case, it's one of the northernmost places on Earth. It's located somewhere between Norway and the North Pole. And in our first interview, Eric had said,
"The place we're playing, there's a law in the city saying that if you're walking the streets, you have to have someone carrying a rifle because of so many polar bears. The polar bears are three times the amount of people that are there."
Well,
and it's, you know, it can be pretty bad. And with global warming, the polar bears are heading down south, and they're further into close to the cities now. It's a little
You almost hope to see some, of course.
I do. I really hope to see a polar bear chasing somebody else. I'd love to see that. As long as I'm not involved in it.
And today, in the car, Eric thinks back to it.
This show was really outstanding, and I got to give credit to the fans who flew in there from all over the world.
Because this town itself didn't provide enough Manowar fans to fill the hall, right?
It was such a small town. It was just a small little place. It was the most northern inhabitable place that you could go, farthest north.
Yeah.
And I did see a polar bear there.
Did you?
At the airport, they had a stuffed polar bear reminding people that there are polar bears in the area.
So nothing you had to run from?
No. As a matter of fact, when the day we flew out of there, some of the crew members and myself, none of the rest of the band members didn't go, but I did, went on a dog sled ride out there. Yeah, that was great. It was, you know, we got on the sleds and we had to meet the dogs first.
Yeah.
And, you know, we hooked the dogs up ourselves, and they were all excited about, you know, going. They knew it was going to happen, you know. They were all excited about it. But it was funny because the guide gave us a quick, you know, lesson on how to break the sleds. And, you know, we drove them ourselves, you know. And it was really cool. And he said, "If you see any polar bears, just keep going. Don't stop to take pictures. Keep going." He says he had a rifle with him because it's a law. One of them had to have a rifle in case, you know, in case it was an issue. So, it was pretty cool.
So why didn't Joey and so on join you?
Well, Joey, I gotta give credit to him. He's busy. He's, you know, he's always on the phone from the minute he wakes up to the minute he goes to bed. He's always doing business. So he couldn't go. The other two guys, they're just sleepy. They didn't want to get their ass up.
Yeah. So we're leaving the main road now, taking a turn to the right, and now it's just a snow-covered track, more or less.
Yep, that's right. Normally we have to walk here. Normally it's a walk. I park the cars up here, and we normally walk it. It's a long, long walk. But today we're going to drive the truck up through here.
So now we're just going across. What is it? Some field? Some grassland?
This is just a field. Some swale field. I'm going right through this cornfield here.
How do you feel about Manowar fans, and not really hunters, but Manowar fans picking up the book and reading it and thus getting to know this side of you? Might be a strange question, but I always had the feeling that, like, for example, hunting and probably also things that you do privately, your passions, that you tend to keep that pretty much separate from your musical persona and career.
Yeah.
Instead of mixing both worlds all that much.
I like the fact that they're interested in what I'm doing, you know, and I try to be as honest as I could be about, you know, what I do out here and why I hunt and you know, how much I enjoy it and everything. I try to be as honest as I can be about that. And I really like the fact that they seem to understand it. Yeah. If I meet fans on tour or something, they always bring it up. Mm. Always bring it up. And so, yeah.
So we have arrived, evidently.
We have arrived.
So what are we looking at? Yeah. Why did you pick this area for today?
Well, because this is where I know there's some deer sign from last season that I saw. I hunted out here a lot last season. You can imagine walking through this cornfield, through an opening here, walking through another cornfield right down there, and then there's another opening, and then way up in that corner up there is where I hunted before.
Yeah.
Up in that far corner. Yeah. Well, that's a long way to go, carrying your backpack, your, you know, heavy clothes, your, you know, everything that goes with the hunt.
Especially if you arrive in darkness and it's really early.
It's all dark. It's all dark. Yeah, it's pitch black. And I don't like to use a flashlight unless I need it, you know.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah. But sometimes you need it, you know what I mean? Especially if the gun season is open. You want to make sure you got a flashlight and let people know that, look, you're not a four-legged deer. You're a two-legged deer here, all right? So, you know.
All right.
Not in season. I got to get my boots on.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave the keys here.
Okay.
So I don't lose them out of my pocket.
Sure. Can also put them in my backpack if you want to, but it should be fine, right?
If somebody walks all the way out here to steal this, they can have it.
They deserve it, right?
That's right.
Okay, so it is cold.
Yes, it is cold. The wind isn't so bad today, but, you know, it's still cold. We get in the woods and the wind will be a lot less.
In front of us stretch fields and forests, completely covered in a dense layer of white, along with a small frozen pond and a light wind. It's an absolute picture book landscape.
That's some serious snow cover.
Yeah.
But not as far as you're concerned, right?
No.
Normally it's like much deeper.
Yeah, this is nothing.
Oh, what's that?
That's a deer print.
You see it?
Yeah, that was a deer print.
Not too bad. I spotted it, right?
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Yeah, there's a deer going into this thicket here.
Yeah, so the snow is getting a bit deeper.
Yeah, we might see the deer.
Do we have to shut up for that?
Nah, the deer know you're here. You know, that's why I go early in the morning. Because when you're walking in, as careful as you can be, the deer still know you're there. Yeah. I fooled them a few times, and I'll tell you a few of the tricks.
To outsmart the animals, Eric comes up with quite a few tricks, and he tells me some of them in the course of our hike.
People think I'm crazy, but, you know, when I'm walking to the woods, you can hear how much noise we're making.
Yes.
Well, I always let other guys go in front of me, and then I say, okay, I'm going to stop, because my tree stand is here, and they just keep walking. Sounds like an army walking along, and I let them go a little ways, and let the deer hear them. And then I'll take two or three steps and I'll stop. Three, four steps, I'll stop. Like a squirrel or like a fox or like a raccoon. You know, they all do that. So
what does that look like?
Well, it sounds like this. We'll go.
Looks like a dance to me.
Right. But what you're doing is, any animal in the wild doesn't have a rhythm to its walk. Except us.
Okay.
We're the only ones that have a rhythm. It's like
rhythm in terms of being very even, right?
And we're walking. And everyone's walking like this.
Yeah.
And everyone does it. Except an animal, a wild animal. They'll take a few steps and stop.
Look around, sniff something.
Sniff something, take three or four steps, stop. You know, it's amazing. And you learn that just from being out in the woods watching them.
So you try to imitate them and people...
I try to imitate the sound.
Yeah.
If the wind is blowing in my face, they can't smell me.
No.
So then I sound like an animal in the woods.
That looks like an old railroad track.
This is an old railroad bed.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It's a real thick area here, and this is, right down below us here, is a swampy area. And it's so hard to, a human can't even walk in there, but deer do.
Yeah.
And they bed, there's a thicket right there, you can see it. That's a bedding area.
Yeah.
They go in there and they bed all the time.
That means they take a nap there? That's where they rest?
Sleep. That's okay. Where they sleep during the day. Nobody can get them.
Another trick of Eric's has the goal of minimizing the human scent that could give him away. Eric wants to prevent the animals from smelling him too easily.
I think I heard in your audiobook that you like to get out to your hunting grounds and collect some soil.
I do, yeah.
And then what happens? It's another potentially a crazy thing, at least as far as other people are concerned.
That's right. I end up going out there with a plastic bag where I'm hunting.
Yes.
And if I'm hunting here, I'll go to a spot here and I'll go down where there's leaves that are down and dirt and leaves. And I kick it up. I use rubber gloves and I throw the dirt in these bags with leaves and acorns or anything. If I'm hunting an area where there's pine trees, the pine needles go in there. Depends where I'm going to hunt. And then I put my hunting clothes in there after I've washed them.
In the bag with the dirt.
Yeah.
And then you close it?
I wash the clothes in a scent-free soap.
Yeah.
Hang them out to dry on a line so that there's no dryer smell. Then I take them when they're dry and I put them in the bag. And I shake them up like shake and bake. You shake them up and it's all the dirt and everything, the leaves and everything gets permeated into the fibers of your outfit. And they stay in my truck. And it's usually in the back of the truck. When I get to my spot, I change. Right where we, you know, I'd be changing my clothes right there.
Yeah.
So I don't put my clothes on and then walk to go to a gas station and fill up the truck, you know.
Covered in dirt. People would really think you are definitely crazy and dangerous.
That's right. That's right. There's a tree stand right there. See it?
I just see the...
See the black line going across
yes.
there? That's a strap.
Yes.
And it's holding that stand on.
But where's the stand? I just see a strap around it.
If you look...
Just this little tiny little thing?
Little tiny thing there. That's where you stand on. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I thought like a tree stand is like a proper little wooden building in a tree. Like comfortable
sitting
with a door potentially even.
No, there's no buildings. There's no buildings.
But you know what I mean? Like in a German forest, if you talk about a tree stand, like Hochsitz.
Yeah.
It's a proper construction where you can sit comfortably and... Some are even really big, as I said, with a door and some little open window that, through which you can shoot.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. No, that's not for bow season.
Not this kind of comfort here.
No, not for bow season.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If the deer come up from this area here, and they like to come up this area a lot, they come up through here.
You even see an antler down there on the ground.
You see an antler?
A little, like the white thing.
Oh, look at that. You're right. Very good.
Let's try to get it, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty steep. We're going off the railroad track.
I'll go down and get it. I'll grab it.
Okay.
Very good.
Eric makes his way down a steep slope to retrieve the antlers that I spotted.
Look at that. It's an old bitch. Yeah.
Looks like a good one.
Yeah, it's cool. It's excellent.
So what are we looking at?
These are antlers.
Yeah. So that's a four ender or three ender? How do you count them?
So,
1, 2, 3, 4.
Four pointer.
So, yeah.
So it would have been from an 8-point buck.
Yeah.
Antlers shed every year.
Yeah.
Horns do not.
No.
Like a bison.
Yeah.
They have horns.
Yeah.
They stay on there year round. But these fall every year and they grow new ones every year.
Yeah.
No one got this one, so next year it'll be a bigger one.
Nice.
I don't know if you want it or not. You want it?
Sure. Do you collect them?
No, I don't bother anymore. I used to. I used to.
Your house would be full of them, I know.
I don't bother with them anymore.
Yeah, it's a nice souvenir, I guess.
Yeah, take it. There's another tree stand. It's hard to see.
I see it. So, can you describe one of these tree stands for people who don't see it, which are all our listeners? What does it look like?
That particular stand is called a hang-on stand.
Yeah.
And you see the steps going up to it. There's steps on one tree. And you step over into that onto that platform.
Yeah.
Hope the hell it doesn't break. Buckle yourself in. I strap myself in with a harness so I'm safe. And then I pull up my bow and my bag and everything else.
I have to tell you, when I listen to your book, and I also know like from all your course teachings, you're very much about tree stand safety.
Oh,
like, you need a harness, you need this, you need that. And honestly, I was always thinking, okay, I mean, he is a little bit ridiculous because I know what a tree stand looks like. I have climbed many of them.
Yeah.
I don't need a harness for that. But honestly, now I understand why they are different from what I'm used to.
Yeah, I mean, if it's, you could be climbing up there and if you don't have a big platform to stand on, for one thing.
Yeah.
And there could be ice on that platform. It's metal.
Yeah.
So better be safe than sorry. I always wrap myself in a harness.
It's like a climbing gear, right? Normal climbing.
Yeah, and before I do anything else, I'm hooked to that tree so I can't fall.
Yeah.
Even if I slip and fall, I'm going to be hanging there for a while and I can pull myself back up. Yeah. I'm not going to get hurt, yeah. You know. So I can laugh about it. I can tell all my friends and they'll have a good time laughing. But yeah, I'm real careful, real careful. This is the way I walk when I hunt. I've got a stand down here that we'll go to now that I've had some success in. And so I personally like to hunt out here. The guys I hunt with, they'll pick these stands closer to the vehicle.
Okay, it's too far for them.
And I walk a long way. But that's okay. That's part of it. That's part of the hunt. You see the field out here?
Yes.
We're not allowed to hunt that. That's somebody else's property. But the deer like to hang in that field a lot because it's green vegetation. And they feed in there all the time, especially when this corn is picked. There's nothing else for them to eat, so they eat there.
No.
It's real tough to get them to come over. But during the rut, during the mating season, we can get them to come in.
How do you try to get them over?
They have calls, deer calls, and you try to sound like a female. I've had success with it all the time,
okay.
Yeah. And you try to sound like a buck, too.
Yeah.
The antlers you're holding right there, if you have two of them, you rattle them together. You bang them together like they're fighting. Two bucks are fighting. And what's happening is, in nature, when you have two bucks smashing their antlers together, they're doing it because there's a hot female. She's an estrus. She's ready to mate right then and there. So they're fighting to see who's going to mate that female. And the attraction is another buck hears that. He knows there's an estrus doe very close. So he comes into the sound of that.
Yeah.
And he scoops up on that doe, and they both walk off together while these two bucks are still fighting. And when they're done fighting, they look around, where the hell's the doe? Where'd she go? that's why. So when it happens, when you call in a buck by rattling the antlers, you're never going to forget it, I'll tell you. That's an exciting time.
Because they just come running at you, more or less.
I had one time I was hunting. Didn't see anything all morning long. It was late in the morning. I took my rattling antlers and I tried it just for the hell of it. Nothing. Tried it again. All of a sudden I heard this snowball. And I said, what the hell is that? What the hell is that? Look in, I could see a deer coming that fast, coming right down to me. And I was rattling, that deer came from me to that stump away. I was up in a tree and I'm watching it. I had the rattling antlers in my hand. My bow is hanging on the tree over here, and I'm looking at it. Holy shit. Holy shit. There's the buck right there. And the buck, you ever see a dog when he's mad and his hair goes up?
Yeah.
That's how the deer looked. Wow. His hair was up. His eyes were huge. His nostrils were big. And he was stiff leg looking for that.
He was ready to engage.
He was ready for action, and I was like, "Holy shit! Look at that! Oh my god!" And I didn't my fire. I didn't my weapon. My bow was hanging in the tree.
Bad preparation, but a special experience.
You know what? Another good hunt.
Yeah.
I never get a deer that day, but boy, it was a great hunt.
Yeah.
Never forgot it.
And if you are making the sounds of a buck, what does that sound like?
It's a grunt that we use.
Yeah. Do you use any kind of special tool for that?
I should have brought some with me.
Some special whistle? Or what
I can
it?
Actually stop. I'll stop back at the hotel with a grunt call, and I'll show you the different sounds. You can edit it in.
Sure.
But it sounds a lot like... Like that, real deep grunt. And the higher the sound, the younger the deer.
Okay.
You know.
As nice as it is when Eric himself imitates these deer calls, it sounds even better with the right equipment. And as he has just promised, he'll come by my hotel later and demonstrate it for me. And that sounds like this.
Okay, so this is called a grunt call. And deer make these different vocalizations throughout the season. A young deer, if you press this button up here, a young deer is going to sound like this. That sounds like a fawn that's a baby deer looking for mommy, all right? And any doe that's in the area that hears that will answer. She'll come and try to find the young one. So here it is again. That's a young deer.
If I press the middle button, it's a young buck, like a spike or maybe a four-pointer. But and that's how he sounds. If I press down further, it's a bigger deer. If I let it go altogether, it's a bigger deer. And if I cup my hand on the end of my grunt call to make the grunt sound longer, this is really deep.
That's a really old one, I guess.
That's the one I'm going to hunt, because he's a big one. He's been around a while. He's pretty smart. He didn't get that big being stupid,
yeah.
So I'm going to try to get him. But if I hear that, if I hear this, I'm getting excited. I'm getting excited. And they do that mostly during the rut.
So this works kind of like a flute, this tool that you're showing to me, right?
The reed is in here, and you just
blowing in.
Put air in. That's it. Yeah, it's really... Works well.
Nice.
It works really well.
So they hear it and they come.
Yeah, they hear it and they come. That's it. Not all the time. Yeah. I mean, that's what hunting's about. Sometimes you fool the animal. Sometimes the animal gets you. That's what it's all about, you know? And like I told you before, if you fool the animal and he comes in within your range and you've got a full draw on him, you know you're going to take him, that's the hunt. It's over.
Back to the forest. In the meantime, a flurry of snow has set in. It's becoming increasingly dense and only making the winter forest more picturesque. Eric explains that he rarely uses utensils like the one that he has just shown me.
Personally, I like to leave things alone and let nature take its course. If I do the scouting correctly, I know where the deer are. You can see.
We are just following their tracks, right?
Yeah, we're following their tracks right now.
Are you able to guess how old they are?
Not from their tracks, but you can tell if it's a big deer or not from their tracks.
So what do these tracks tell you?
Well, if you see a track that's small like this, that's usually a fawn, a baby deer. If you see a track that's like this, that's a big deer.
That looks like a hoof of a horse, size-wise, right?
Right.
Is that what we hear?
Geese. Two geese.
Do you also hunt them?
I used to, but I don't because I don't eat them.
Okay.
And I don't know anybody now who takes them, so I don't bother taking them.
So now we're in the middle of the woods. What's this forest? How would you characterize it? What does it look like? Which kind of trees are here?
Well, there's a lot of oak trees here, maple trees. New York State's known for a lot of maple trees. And you should make sure you get some maple syrup.
Should I? Yeah.
It comes from New York. This is where it's made.
Okay.
Yeah. They tap the trees.
Yeah.
They get the syrup right from the tree, and then they melt it down, and it makes great syrup. You'd like it.
So that's your tree stand. Your main one?
No, it's one of the ones, not the main one, but I like hunting out of it. Depends on the wind direction. If the wind is coming out of the west, which blows in this direction, that stand's not good. But if the wind's coming out of the east. Or the south, that stand is great to be in. So I got to kind of play the wind and see. I've got different stands in this area that, you know, are there for a reason, for the wind direction. So
if I look at the stand, it's pretty exposed, of course.
It is now.
Yeah.
It is now.
Of course, because there are no leaves. But how are you like if you sit in a stand like this and then the weather turns bad and it's cold and rainy? Are you like a tough guy and sitting it out and like, what the hell, I'm a survivor, I will do what I need to do? Or are you like, oh no, that's too ridiculous, let's get the hell out of here?
You see how far we walk? Okay, if I'm out here and I get out here and I finally get my spot, I'm not leaving. I've got an umbrella.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I got an umbrella that straps to the tree. Hooks
like a fancy umbrella?
No, it's just a huge camouflage umbrella.
Okay.
And it covers if it gets really shitty out. That's what I use.
Yeah.
And I don't use it that much, though. You can kind of look and see what the weather's going to do here.
I think in your book you say, just hang on a second, please.
Yeah.
In the book you say the treetop stand for you is like your classroom.
Yeah, it is. That's right.
What do you learn in this classroom while you sit in it?
I learn a lot about the deer behavior more than anything. Mm-hmm. I could sit up there and watch them. If I choose not to take that deer, that's what I like best, because if I choose not to take that deer,
I'm sitting down. I'm not paying any attention to, you know, my heart's not beating fast. I'm not putting on any scent or anything. You know, I just sit there and I watch them. And I think a deer have a sixth sense. I really do. Because the wind could be perfect. Everything could be perfect. If you're going to shoot at that deer and you got your bow and you're ready to go.
You pull the string.
You pull the bow back. You're ready to go. For some reason, everything could be right. All of a sudden, the deer will stop. Look around like something's not right. There's studies now that are being done that it's an some kind of electro field that you're emitting out of your body. I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know. But I have seen deer react to a trouble when I know they can't smell me. They can't smell me. I'm not moving, but they know something is wrong. And they just look around like, they look around. And you got to wait. You just got to wait for your shot. Sometimes they'll stand there, and if they look in your direction, they'll go like that.
One step.
Yeah. They'll stomp real hard, like real hard down the ground, and they're trying to make you jump. You know,
I see. Yeah.
They're trying to make you jump, or they'll go like that. If they snort like that, they know something's up. And when they blow like that, that tells every deer in the area, we got trouble here.
Interesting.
So you learn that as you're just watching in the tree.
Nice.
You learn a lot. It's really interesting.
It is a very nice area. I can imagine in summer you feel really like totally encapsulated.
Can I tell you something? Just stop for a minute. Is that great or what? Is that great? Just listening to nothing.
Yeah.
A little bit of wind coming through. And every once in a while you hear, ch-ch-ch. You think it's a deer, it might be a squirrel, it could be anything. It's
I just love it out here. I mean, I love it.
Last time you told us how you got into hunting in the first place, which was through introduction by your dad.
Yeah, my dad.
But you didn't tell us how you got into bow hunting. So what was your very first bow hunting experience like?
Well,
this is a funny story. I was in high school, and the guy sitting behind me ended up being one of my best friends to this day. He asked me what I was doing over the weekend. I said, nothing. He said, why don't you get a bow and come over to my house, we'll shoot. I said, all right. So I went out, bought some cheap bow, you know, cheap wooden arrows. I didn't know what I was doing. And out in his backyard, we're shooting. And it was good. I was having fun. I was hitting the target and saying, oh, this is great. No problem. I shoot five or six arrows. I'm ready. Let's go. Let's go hunting. So his father took us hunting. Shouldn't have been out there. Now that I know, I shouldn't have been out there. But I thought at the time, holy shit, you're Robin Hood. Let's go. So I went out there, and towards the end of the day, we were hunting in this big fire break. And what that is there's woods on one side. There's a big, long open area, woods on the other side, okay?
Like a corridor for fire management.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we were there, and I was standing on the one side of the fire break. His father, the guy's father who brought us on, was combing, walking through the woods like we're doing, and he's spooking the deer. The deer get up, and they say, there's somebody coming, and they move. But they're not running. They walk away from him and towards us. So I said, this is going to work out great. So I'm standing up there. My buddy was down the hill a little ways from me. It went down like this. I couldn't see him, but I knew he wasn't far. And all of a sudden, Eric, I heard, whoosh, whoosh. Whoosh, whoosh. The hell is that? Whoosh, whoosh. I looked like this, and there's a doe coming right to me from the other side of the fire break, walking along. I said, holy shit, holy shit. So I answer, and he goes, and I go, like that. So he knew, I saw.
So you replied.
Yeah. He knew that I saw it. I'm like, this is holy shit. My heart was going fast. I'm thinking, this is it. Holy
Did
shit.
You get your bow ready?
I was ready. I was on the ground.
Yeah.
I was standing there on the ground with this cheap bow, wooden arrows. I said, what the? I said, this is nothing. Holy shit. Here comes the deer, come walking up. The wind was perfect. The wind was blowing this way up in my face. The deer had no idea I was there. It was close. I mean, it's embarrassing to tell you how close it was. It was really close. See that small tree right in front of us?
Yeah.
That's where it was.
Okay.
Oh, that's close. Yeah. All right.
And it's a big animal.
It's a big doe. It's a, you know, it didn't have a rack on it, but it was a doe. Yeah. I didn't care if it was a mouse. I would have taken a shot. I pulled back. I said, holy shit. I got the full draw. The deer had no idea I'm there. It's there feeding on the ground. Look, I said, oh my God, this is great.
This is the moment.
This is it. I went, with the arrow fly, and I hit the deer right in the hoof.
Oh, no.
And the deer looked at me like, what the hell are you doing? And it bounded in the woods right in front of me and stopped there and looked at me like I'm thinking, oh, shit, how can I do that? I didn't even hit the deer. Oh, my God, how could you miss that close? And I said, well, he's going to come back out because the guy's walking this way.
Yeah.
I never saw the deer again, neither did anybody else, but I told everybody about it, and all I heard was laughter. Yeah. All the way. Oh, he's hooked now. He's dead. And I was. I was hooked right then and there because my heart, I didn't think I could beat that fast. I said, holy crap, that was fun. That was fun.
That should have earned you the nickname Robin Hood, I guess, right?
Right. Oh, that was fun.
We hike on and look for rubs, trees on whose bark the deer rubbed the antlers to get rid of the deer velvet. Deer velvet is the highly perfused and very sensitive bast skin that eventually dies and is rubbed off on trees.
See, here's another one over here.
Oh, yeah.
You find one, you find a bunch. You hit his horns, his antlers there, and he rubs it off. Pretty cool. So there's bucks in the area.
It shows me that if you know what you're looking for, you can find all kinds of tracks and signs in the forest, signs that escape the untrained eye.
I just see maybe snow and trees, but you see whole stories of animal movements.
Oh, yeah, you do. You really do. Like there's a squirrel right there.
Yeah.
You know, you just see all different tracks everywhere. But the best is when it's still just dawn and you're in your spot. And everything's waking up around you, you know?
Just total quiet and calm.
I had a male cardinal bird. I don't know if you know where they are.
No, it's but I will Google it.
It's a red bird
yeah.
with a black, red and black. They're gorgeous. They really are pretty. He landed on my arrow.
Yeah, you told me about that, yes. He thought you were a branch, right?
Yeah.
Because you were so
slow. Landed right on the arrow, and I'm watching him. He was really, just so cool, you know? Things like that. Yeah. People don't see in their living room.
What does the word comfort zone mean to you? When are you really in your comfort zone? Because as we said, it's not always comfortable out here.
No, it's not. It's comfort zone for me is back at the truck when I'm sitting down in the truck and I got a deer in the back end. I'm comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not too comfortable in these stands, you can tell. You know?
I climbed one of them. I think I was on the more comfortable one, right?
You were. That's the most comfortable stand we have here. Yeah.
So there are a few challenges, especially, of course, with bow hunting. We talked about it briefly. Bow hunting is quite a bit more challenging than rifle hunting, for example, in many ways.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. I mean, if you're rifle hunting, if I could hunt this property,
yeah.
I could shoot a deer with a rifle. You can shoot a deer as far as you can see.
On the other side of the field.
Yeah, as far as you can see.
So is this, like, voluntarily deciding for the bigger adventure and the bigger challenge? Is this
yeah.
something that you tend to do in other parts of your life as well? Is that something you find pleasure in?
I find pleasure in hunting deer. I don't think about the rest of my life. I try to take the easy route.
Okay.
Like everybody else. But
well, I remember, for example, with Manowar, you recorded a song in about a 20 languages or something.
18 languages, yeah.
That sounds like a challenge. That was not really necessary.
Well, a funny story about that. We were doing a press interview. I don't know what country we were in. And the four of us were sitting there at a table. And one of the journalists asked, you know, any surprises coming up for the next album, blah, blah, blah. And then Joey says, well, we're going to do a song in 18 languages. And I leaned over, I says, we are? I said, and we started laughing at that. I said, you're going to play bass once. I got to sing 18 languages? He says, yeah, I'm going to tell you about it later. I said, okay, there you go. And it was Father. And then we ended up doing Father 18 languages. That was hard. That yeah. was really hard.
How long did that take you?
Many, many, many days. They would schedule it. What happened was the whole system, how it happened was Joey wrote the song. It's a beautiful track. He wrote the song.
It's a ballad.
Beautiful. Yeah. He wrote the song. and we got a hold of fans from different parts of the world, and we asked them if they'd be interested in putting that song in their language. Yeah. And of course they said, yeah, let's do it. But they had to sign a non-disclosure agreement because we couldn't let that song out until it was released. So after the non-disclosure agreement was taken care of, sent them the lyrics to the song, and then they put it in their language. And then we would schedule when I was going to be doing. In other words, they would say, the secretary would call up the person and say, call up Germany and say, okay, Eric is recording right now in Hungarian. He'll be done with this in 2 days. He'll be ready to do Germany on Wednesday. Are you going to be available? Yes. He'll call you at 4 o'clock your time in the afternoon, which is 10 o'clock in the morning for us here. That's how we did it. We would call them, get them on Skype. Yeah. They could see me recording. I could see them. And we do it line at a time. I do it line. I say, how is that? Well, is it it?
One line at a time. That is challenging to sing this way, right?
It was really challenging. And the hard thing was, if I got the pronunciation right, they would say, oh, finally, yes, the pronunciation was perfect. It was perfect. But the feeling isn't there. I want to say, stick the feeling up your ass. I got the song down, didn't I? But no, I didn't do it. You know, that's the challenge of it all. You gotta make it right. And that's one thing I can honestly say. If it's not right, it doesn't get released, period. That's all there is to it. It's got to be right.
What was the most challenging language?
Hungarian.
Hungarian? Why?
I did Japanese in one afternoon. Because the vowel sounds that we make as Americans are similar to the Japanese. But Hungarian is a language all in itself. It's very, very difficult. And I didn't understand. There are like 4 or 5 different ways to say different pronunciations of that same lettering. And I'm thinking, man, this is really, really, really hard. And at one point, I just threw my headphones up in the air. I says, this is bullshit. I can't do this language. And I was 4 days into it. Couldn't do it. And the person on the other end said, we're so close. It's good. You can do it. We're so close. And they talked me into doing it. But boy, whew.
Did you get upset at one point at Joey for making you do this?
No, I didn't. I really didn't. It was just... It's just
a fun challenge.
It's a fun challenge, and when you're done, you're done. Yeah. And it wasn't only a challenge for me. Come on, it was a challenge for the engineer, the assistant engineer. Everybody's hearing the same song for months.
And cutting all these outtakes out again and again. All this deletion, you know, press delete. Okay, that's not
right.
It.
That's not right, not right. At one point, I asked, I didn't hear the difference. I listened to how they pronounce it.
Honestly, that must be frustrating for you.
It is.
I mean, I'm married to a Chinese, as I've told you.
Uh-huh.
They have a difficult language.
Yeah.
He's trying to teach me. And, you know, you can say the same thing, like, in 5 different tones. Ma, 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 whatever.
Yeah.
Ma. And it means something completely different. So whenever I try to say something, there's so often a situation that he pretends, and I tend to believe him, he really doesn't understand me.
Yeah, right.
And I repeat it again and again. No, I don't get it, Eric. I repeat it again. And then at some point, he says, like, that ni hao, all right. And I'm like, that's exactly what I said. Are you trying to, you know...
Bullshit me now. Yeah, that's crap.
That's probably what you felt like with Hungarian.
I did, because I didn't... Well, not only Hungarian, but the Polish language. Yeah. There's, you know, a lot of different languages that were... I didn't hear the difference. And I would... The person would say the word, and I would go and sing it, and I'd say that word. Nope, not right. Say it again, not right. All right, say it again, not right. I said, Jesus Christ. I go to the engineer, I said, do you hear a difference? He's German. He said, no, I don't hear anything. I go to the assistant, who was Mexican. I said, how about you? You hear anything? Nothing. I don't hear the difference. But the guy insisted.
At least you knew you didn't go and say it.
Right, it wasn't just me. You know, when we recorded... song in French, Courage.
Yeah.
It was Joey, myself, and the engineer, and in the recording booth with me was the French promoter. And I'd sing this song. I get to this one line, I sing this one line, and the engineer says, not right, this is not right. You have to do it again. I said, okay, roll it back. Let's do it again. Seeing again. Nope, not there. It's not right. I said, all right, roll it again. And Eric, I did it. I must have done it, I'm not kidding you, 50 times, at least, maybe more. I would sing it, and he says, this is not right, this is not right. I looked over to the French promoter who was standing next to me. I said, is it good for you? He said, this is good for me. This sounds good for me. I said, Joey, how does it sound to you? He says, what do you have for me? I'm American, I don't know. I said, the engineer, how about you? He says, not right. I said, okay, I sing it again. I said, how about it? Is it good for you? And the promoter, he says, this is good. It sounds great for me. Engineer, got to do it again. And over and over and over again. And I finally said, fuck this. I took my headphones. I threw them high as I could up in the studio. And I said, fuck this shit. I'm done with this shit. You got it? And I hear Joey say, I think we're done for the day. and I started laughing, see?
Okay, but you can lose your temper is what you're saying.
Yeah, I do have a slight temper, to say the least. I do have a temper, right?
Are there people that are scared of you?
There are times when I've blown up so bad that it's better you just walk away from me. Because I get hot at times.
Does need to happen in order for that to happen?
Well, stupidity, basically. You know, stupidity that I think is stupid anyway. And I've been in this business a long time. You know what I mean? When someone does something stupid, because that's just the way it's got to be. And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, come on, you know. But I get pissed off about it. Yeah, my wife says I got a temper. I don't know. She says I snore too, but I stayed up one night to find out, and I didn't snore. I don't know what the hell she's talking about. But careful, this could be slippery here.
Yeah. Getting back to the car.
Yeah.
So, back in the car, how do you feel?
I'm tired.
Are you tired?
I'm warmer now, I can tell you that. It's a hell of a walk we did.
Yeah.
A long ways.
But it was really nice. Thanks for that.
Yeah, my pleasure, believe me. I like being out here.
Yeah.
I do.
Are you hungry? I brought some little snacks.
No, no, okay. I'm hungry at all. Thank you,
though. I brought fruit and chocolate just to keep you happy. So, in case, you know, we have a survival situation.
You Germans are really prepared, I gotta tell you.
No, I just wanted to, you know, if you get hungry or whatever,
yeah.
Or me, not pretending that I only thought of you. In the beginning of our conversation in the hotel room, when we were still cozy and warm, you hinted at the fact that when doing your book, the most fun was doing the last chapter,
yeah. The
mishaps, the hunting mishaps.
Yeah, it was
and
really good.
For people to really enjoy all these mishaps, of course, they should listen to the book.
Yeah.
But maybe you can give us one or two teasers. For example, I remember a turkey hunt gone wrong. I particularly enjoyed that.
Okay, all right, okay. Well, first I got to tell you something, Eric, and I told you in the woods, but for those listening, everything in that book, it's true. It's the last chapter when I say hunting mishaps, things that happen in the woods that are funny, it's all true, and that's what makes it even funnier. But this turkey hunt you're talking about, I had a friend who never missed a meal, if you catch my drift, okay? And he wanted me to take
him. He was not a lightweight.
He wasn't a lightweight, no. It was like a bull in a china shop. But he wanted to go turkey hunting, and he knew that I could call a bird in. So he asked me if I would, you know, take him turkey hunting and call a bird in for him. I says, okay, let's go. I know a spot where the turkeys sleep up in the trees. I know a spot where they roost. I said, let's go. So we got there. It was similar to this. We had to walk in the field first, and then you got to the edge of the woods, and I whispered to him, I said, okay, listen now. We have to walk right underneath the turkeys because they fly in one direction every morning. And they're not going to change just because we're here. They're going to fly in that same direction. So we've got to go by the turkeys where they sleep and set up on the opposite side of them someplace. It's okay. So we started walking, and I can hear crunch, 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 crunch. Crunch behind me, and I stopped. I said, Bobby, I said, heel toe. Think heel toe, all right? Put your heel down, and before you put your weight on anything, make sure it's not going to make a lot of noise.
Avoid the branches. Just be very gentle.
Yeah, I said, because things are, we're getting closer. Okay, okay. We walk a little bit further, and I'm going to crack, bang, crack. I stopped again. I said, Bobby, put your feet where my feet are. Watch where I put my foot. Just put your foot right in that spot. Okay, yeah. I said, I'm sorry. Okay, okay. We did, and it happened like three or four more times where we'd walk and crash, bang, crack. I stopped. I said, Bob, Bob.
Was that one of the moments when you almost lost your temper?
Yeah, I said, Bob. Because you have to get up real early for turkey season. You, I mean, I'm talking 3 in the morning. You've got to get up early. I said, Bob, we're almost right underneath the birds now. I said, you got to be quiet. Just be quiet. And he says
you're
he was
pleading with him.
And
really?
he was leaning. He puts his arm up against a tree, leaning. And he goes, yeah, I know. I'm going to. And the whole tree starts. Bang! The tree smashes down, and the birds go flying everywhere. And we just started laughing like, okay, well, there's our hunt for the day. Let's go back to the car now. We're trying to be so quiet that when he leans his hand against the tree, the whole goddamn tree came down. Oh, my God, it was funny. Yeah. And I said in the book, I said, well, that just goes to show that if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, it makes a hell of a racket. Oh, that was really funny. That's in the book. Yeah,
that's in the book. And many more stories like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
I convince Eric to tell one more story. This one is about a young guy he and his hunting friends took along for the very first time.
He was like the youngest hunter in the group. The guys we all hunted, we had our own group. And we went down to this hunting camp every year during gun season, every year. And the evening of opening day was like a celebration, really. We go there and, you know, guys would play cards and we'd just shoot the breeze with each other. Just a guy thing, you know. Have a few drinks and you have a good time. And when it came time to go to bed, it was just a shack, really. It wasn't a nice cabin or anything. It was just shack, okay? As a matter of fact, and I didn't say this in the book, but I'll tell you, we used to go down there and clean it and make sure the mice were gone and all this stuff before this we used it. And one year we brought the wives down there with us. And when my wife saw this place, she says, okay, well, there's the outhouse. Where's the actual cabin? I said, this is where we sleep. This is it. Anyway.
So that didn't help you convincing her of sharing your outdoor experiences more often?
No, not at all. So we decided, okay, you know, it was bedtime. And we all had our guys. We kind of slept with the same guys all the time. And I always slept, it was a bed that, a couch that pulled out to a bed. So it wasn't the most comfortable thing in the world, but it was a place to rest. So this guy who's now passed away, Ron Swietnowski, and I, we always hung out together. So we were assigned to this bunk, all right, as we were sleeping. And there were no other extra bunks. So this one kid, the new kid, ended up sleeping on a cot in like a hallway, like in between where the other beds were. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty crowded area. So he was laying there, and I told Ron, I said, let's really get this kid. And I told him what I wanted to do, you know. He says, that's good. Okay, we can do that. Okay. So the lights went out, and we waited about 5 or 10 minutes after the lights were out. It was quiet in the place.
And it was probably really small, right? I mean, it was crowded.
It was crowded.
People.
It was crowded. Yeah, it was really crowded. And the kid was laying next to us, but it was so dark in that place. Honestly, you couldn't see your hand in front of your eye. You couldn't see right in front of you. It was pitch black in the place. You couldn't see anything. And we started to make sounds. We started to make sounds like we were making love to each other, okay? groaning and, you know, I take my cheek and I move my cheek up and down, so it sounded like this if I go... Like that. Oh, and the other guy's going, oh, yeah, that's it. Oh, yeah, that's good. And this kid's listening to this. He finally says, oh, my God. And he stands up in the dark, and there was a big beam in the middle.
Like a pole. Like a
Yeah, holding the pole. And he didn't see it. Bang! And this beam, we hear a thud. Somebody turns the lights on, and this kid is laying down there. Like, he didn't know what the hell happened. And everyone started laughing. And then the kid found out, and I walked up to the kid and went...
With your cheek? Yes.
With my cheek. And he started laughing. Oh, my God. That was funny. That was really funny. I said, welcome to the group there, kid.
Oh. very good, very good. Oh,
yeah, there's a lot of funny stories like that. Jesus.
All right. Well, I think we have to head back, right?
Yeah, we're head back now.
Yeah, very fun. Good time, yeah, huh? Good time.
I'm glad you made the trip up here. It was really nice of you to do it. It was fun. Good to see you again.
Absolutely, yeah. Maybe I will ask you one or two questions while we're driving home before we take the final farewell, but
no problem. It
was a great being out here with you.
Yeah, you too.
So this is the end of our little exploration and the end of many hunts. Is, of course, if you are lucky enough to get an animal, not only to kill it, to shoot it, but also, I mean, to harvest it, to cut the meat. You know, the actual work starts after taking the shot.
Absolutely.
And, of course, for you, that's quite a bit easier because you are trained in that. You have been a professional meat cutter for quite a few years.
Yeah, I think. 16 years. I cut meat for 16 years. And that's that was a good thing and a bad thing. It was a good thing because I knew how to cut up my own deer.
Yeah.
And I could take care of it and bone it out. And it took about an hour to do a deer. It was nothing. The bad thing was all your friends knew you could do it, too.
So that is a problem.
So whoever got a deer, you know, if there were the one time there were seven of us all got deer. And it takes an hour per deer.
Wow.
And for seven straight hours,
Eric,
I was cutting
you
up
do
deer.
It. It's fast if you do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You can do it. Now, don't. The problem was, and I didn't mind. I didn't mind doing it. What I did mind was when I got done with somebody's deer, they said, oh, geez, I've got an appointment. I got to go. I can't help you with the rest of them. I'm sorry. I got to go. And everybody, one at a time, said that. I got to go after they got their deer done. They had to, all of a sudden, they had to leave. So I said, this is crap. This is crap. So then I said, listen, you guys are going to cut your own deer from now on. I'm going to show you how to do it. And I took them all, and I said, here's where you got to put the knife. Here's where you got to cut. This is called the sirloin tip. This is called the loin. This is your tenderloin. I went one right after another, and they got it done right. Now they do their own.
Well done.
Well done. That's it. I do mine, and I do a friend of mine. The two of us work together. Yeah, and that's it.
How did that happen, that you became a meat? By the way, before I ask that question, we have a beautiful view right now. We are coming down a hill on a little path, and we're looking down at the lake.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, isn't it?
It's really beautiful here. Yeah. So how did it happen that you became a meat cutter? I guess that was not always your dream job while growing up.
No, I was a meat cutter. I just needed a job when I was a kid, you know. I was already playing in a band, but we'd only play out on weekends, you know. And I needed a job. My parents had 10 kids, you know. If I wanted something, I had to pay for it. Yeah. So,
it would be really self-reliant from an early age on.
Yeah, really. So, I just said, okay, I need a job somewhere. My brother was working there as a meat cutter at the time.
It wasn't a big market, right?
Yeah, and he said, geez, they're looking for a cleanup kid, you know. So, I was 16, and I went there, and the owner, who's a real nice guy, he's like my second dad. I owe him everything. I really do. I owe him a lot. He's just a great guy. Jim Hogan was his name. He's still alive today. He hired me to clean the machines, to take them apart. Every day I had to clean the machines.
Like after a full market day of meat cutting,
after
you were the one who had to clean the machines. Yeah, that probably was not an easy job, right?
I had to learn how to take them all apart and wash them and get them back together again. And they had to be inspected by a federal meat inspector every morning to make sure everything was going to be
really clean.
And then one Saturday I went there to clean the machines. They asked me to come in early. And I came in early. It was very, very busy. And one of the guys said, just wait on people. Ask what they want and go from there. So the meat was usually...
He asked you to serve people, serve clients who came.
Yeah, people came. What do you need? You know, a pound of hamburger, get that for. You know, a couple steaks. They pick them out. I pull them out of the case. One person wanted me to get them some fresh tenderloin. And, I mean, I've seen how it was done. I watched other cutters do it. But I never did it. And I went to one of the main cutters, and I said, this person wants tenderloin, which is the most expensive cut of meat, okay? You don't want to mess it up. It's pretty expensive. And the guy told me, he says, I don't have time. Just do it. I said, I don't know if I want it. I don't want to mess it up. He says, you want to be meat cutter? I says, yeah. He said, then cut meat. Just do it. I said, okay. So then I did it. I went in the cooler and I got tenderloin, pulled the tenderloin off and got the sinew away from it, pulled it out and cut some steaks, butterflied them open. And from that day on, okay, I was a meat cutter. I learned how to do it from watching other guys do it, and they teach me certain things. And I ended up being a head cutter there. I was the guy who went in at 7 o'clock in the morning, and my job was to fill the case, make sure they were full with fresh meat before the other guys got there. But it was nice because I got to leave at 3 in the afternoon or 2 in the afternoon somewhere.
Yeah.
And Jim Hogan was so nice. Whenever the band had to play out on a weekend, which was a lot.
A weekend which probably also was the busiest time for
Friday
business.
Friday night, the cutters went there Friday night and they stayed late on Friday night because Saturday was the busiest day of the week. And, if I had to play out on a Friday night, Jim Hogan would give me the time off, and all the other cutters, after working all day long, they had to stay and clean up. That's pretty.
Did they hate you?
No, we all got along fine. We really got along fine. They knew that this is what I wanted to be in music. They knew that.
They were happy to support you.
Yeah, they really were. And Jim was just an angel of a man. He really was. He is. To this day, he always asks me, how's the singing doing? You know, were you guys playing? To this day.
Yeah.
And he's got to be in his 80s by now. Yeah. He's just a great, great guy, great family. Just, everyone's really good, really nice.
It probably was a tough job to do, right, for all these years? Like, physically tough, because you had to handle big, heavy pieces of meat?
Monday was the day the beef arrived. Yeah. This was in the day. Now the beef comes in boxes today. It's nothing. It's already cut up,
Yeah.
But back then, it was cattle was quartered, okay? So each piece would weigh about 200 pounds or so, 250 pounds. And the guy in the truck would take it and loaded on the truck, and you had to lift it off the truck, take it off the truck, and carry it in the building. And somebody was there with a hook, and you had to hook the beef into this one spot in the beef. And that was kept me in shape. I could tell you that much. That kept me in shape.
That's where all the manoir muscles came from.
That's right. It kept me in shape. Yep.
I mean, today, if we talk about, finding a job as a young person, there's a lot of discussion about self-realization, self-actualization, follow your dream, do what, what gives you purpose.
Yeah.
You said that you grew up in a family with 10 kids.
10 kids, yeah.
So, a big family. You had to, if you wanted something, you had to pay for it from an early age on.
Yeah.
How was the philosophy back then about work and about a passion in your family? Was that even an issue? Or was it just, okay, I need to get money, this is an opportunity to do that, and that's basically the end of the story?
That's a hard question to answer, because our rehearsal hall was at my parents' house. Okay, down the basement of my parents' house, we had a rehearsal space there, and my parents were nice enough to give me permission to give everybody a key to go in the rehearsal hall, so they can practice anytime they wanted to, and that's how I learned how to play other instruments. I just played guitar when I started out, and I learned how to play drums and keyboards and everything, all these other instruments.
Because, do you still do that sometimes?
Yeah. Because guys were down there playing, and I go down there because I heard them upstairs, and so did everybody else. Yeah. My sisters and my parents, they heard somebody out there pounding on the drums, and so I went downstairs, I jam a little bit with the guitar with them, and the drummer wanted to learn how to play guitar. I'd teach him a little bit, and he'd show me the drums, and one thing led to another. So, yeah. So it's a tough question, because My family was, including my sister, my brother, well, my family was behind me to do what I wanted to do. But as I kept doing it, and as I went from one band to another band to another band, after a while, that got old. After a while. And
also, success didn't come immediately.
Success did not come, no. And it was very, very difficult, And when I finally played with Manowar, and I, we had an album out, and we were making our first tour and playing some shows in America. And to this day,
My sisters have never seen me play. One sister has, but that's it. My mother never saw me play. My father came to one sound check. That was it. That was enough for him.
Why? I mean, you already told me last time that even your kids just saw you play once in Italy.
Yeah, my sister came to Italy.
Also, okay.
Yeah, and she saw
why?
Me.
Why didn't they? Why were they not more interested in how you?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know. We have to ask them that. I really don't know what the reason was, but you know.
But they were supportive enough to help you follow this passion and try to realize it.
They were supportive enough to let me know that, to put up with me. You know, if I had to do something, but I had to rehearse first, it was rehearsal first. I'll get to it when I can. I don't know if they put up with it. They just say, oh, you son of a bitch. You know, do what you got to do, you know.
So how is it today with your friends and family? How do they think about the fact that you have your life here in small town America, a normal dude hunting with them, and as soon as you cross the ocean or go to Southern America, even here in America, in the US if you tour, you attract tens of thousands of fans?
Yeah, they...
Do they think it's incredible? Do they care? Do they think, oh, wow, you are living a double life?
My friends? Yes. You're talking about... No, they just wait for me to come home so we can get back together and do what we do.
So really you don't care?
No, they really don't care. It's a job to them.
Yeah.
It's a job to them, you know.
Which it is. So it's a healthy way to
not even, you know, some people say it's a job. The job is travel. That's the job.
Yeah.
You know, playing, we did that one show. It was 5.5 hours long. It didn't bother me a bit. It was fun to do. And just like everybody else in the band. It was just fun to do.
Yeah.
And the fans really dug it. We were having a lot of fun up there. But that's not, to me, it's not work. To me, the work is Joey does most of the work part, you know.
Really the business side.
The business end of it. The work for me is just the travel. The travel gets old.
We're now almost reaching the hotel. I can already see it. So it's almost time for farewell. And I remember that last time when we said goodbye, we talked about you and Manowar saying goodbye as well. Because you just announced that, you know, you would come towards the end of your career. You said something like, Eric, when do you stop? Do you stop when people still want you there? Or do you stop when people don't want you there anymore? And you said you think it's a good time to call it a day. That was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And then you also made a little bit of fun about it because you said, you know, I don't really know if it is our first and final retirement tour or if we are like, whatever, the Scorpions who are saying goodbye like forever and it almost feels like a marketing gag or whatever. Well, what can I say? Now it's 2021 and you just released some tour dates for 2022. So what's the retirement status?
I'm there as long as my voice holds out. I'm going to sing, period. You know, I just love being out there singing. And if it's not on tour, it'll be in the studio recording. But I love being out on tour, you know. Because of COVID and what's going on, we're recording a new album. So we're keeping busy. You know, but once the tour starts, next year's going to be busy. 22 is going to be busy.
And you don't mind that. What changed? What changed from, okay, it's about time to retire to, okay, let's keep going?
Well, it was a meeting we had, and it was time to retire, and I said, okay, one last tour. And then one last tour lasted forever. So, and I'm fine with that. I love being out on that stage.
Yeah.
I love it. I can't wait to get back out again. And now, because we can't play...
You also know what you're missing.
Yeah, exactly right. Nice. Yeah.
Well... I'm looking forward to it. I hope I can be there in Germany.
Yeah. We're playing quite a few shows in Germany coming up, so it'll be good.
Very good.
All right.
I'll see you there. Thank you so much.
All right, Eric. Listen, I got a surprise for you, too. I'm going to go home. I got some venison I'm going to bring back for you, okay, from a deer that I got last season. And I'm going to give you 2 bags of Italian sausage that I made. It's a great recipe.
Isn't that the recipe that's also in your book?
It's in the book. It's in the book.
That's nice. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And 2 packages of steaks. There's about 4 or 5 steaks in each package. So cook it the way you want.
And you hunted them?
Oh, yeah. I got it last season. So it's pretty fresh. It's good.
Thank you so much. Anything I should take into consideration when preparing that meat, when cooking it?
Just be hungry.
I think be hungry. Stay hungry. I think that's a perfect conclusion for our conversation.
You're going to like it. Yeah. I think you'll like it. Yeah.
Thank
you. If you don't, find someone who will. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
That was my little exploration and conversation with Eric Adams. I hope you enjoyed the episode. However, I also know from Eric's last appearance on Unfolding Maps that not only loyal listeners of our podcast will enjoy this episode, but also many Manowar fans who, if we're really honest, otherwise have a little less interest in our show. And they're just happy about the in-depth interview with Eric. For this reason, for those of you who can't and don't want to get enough, here is some bonus material as an appendix, so to speak. A few more interview sequences that didn't make it into the actual episode, but are still worth listening to. After you started Manowar, were you ever tempted to do any major music projects besides that band?
I recorded some stuff of my own.
But you never published it, right?
Never released it. No, I never released it. It needs, you know, today's world, you need a lot of work, and I just didn't have the time or the ambition, I think, to do it, you know. But it was fun for me because I got to play all the instruments, you know, so that was fun.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like I say, those are things that I listen to myself.
Yeah.
That's fine. And then I wrote, when I did the Wildlife and Wild Times video.
Hunting DVD?
Yeah, the hunting DVD. I wrote the music in that and got to play it.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah.
That was fun, so... Yeah, especially the buffalo scene when I played the Indians' music. You know, that was kind of cool.
So, I mean, the forest is quite dense here. How far can you actually shoot from a stand like that without hitting 1,000 branches?
Well, you have to come here and... Wait a minute. You have to come here pre-season and trim branches, trim your shot. If you look, this is where the deer walk?
Yes.
There's a hell of a run that walks all the way down through here. This is where the deer like to walk. Yeah. And they come from over in here, and they walk right through this thicket and then walk up on this side. If they're on this side, you can see I got a clear shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's real clear. But you got to sit still. You got to wait for them. See, I'm not up on... I don't go in that... You see that first level?
Yeah.
Then you go a little bit higher, there's a seat.
Yeah.
That's the second level. That's where I go.
What's the maximum time that you are willing to sit in a stand like that before you are like, okay, that's it for today?
Sunrise to sunset. I've done it before.
No.
That's not pretty. It's not fun. But I have done it. If you're looking for a big buck, and I know a big buck's in the area. I've hunted there in the mornings before. I don't see him. I see sign of him, but I don't see him. And God damn it, I'm going to find where that buck is. So I'm there. All day. I bring sandwiches and food and everything with me. You see now the wind's blowing in this direction.
Yeah.
So the bucks and the deer like to walk in the wind
yeah.
for protection.
Yeah.
So you have to really be careful of your scent control, period.
Yeah.
There's no getting around. And you could do everything where you see I wear these boots when I'm out hunting. They're rubber boots. They're 18 inches up.
Mm-hmm.
And I tuck my camouflage in the boot. I spray the boot down. I spray my body down. I put my clothes in a bag. I do everything I can to avoid human scent. But it doesn't matter what you do. They're going to pick you out. They know you're in the area. They may not know exactly where, but they know you've been here and they know something's up. You know? They're amazing animals. Just amazing. I was down in Ithaca one time. I strapped a seat around one of these trees and I sat there. And I was only scouting. That's all I was doing. And I was looking for turkeys, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
I sat there. My wife thinks I'm nuts because I just go early morning. Instead of sleeping in, I'm out in the woods. And I'm sitting there, and I see a deer. I saw a deer way down in the woods working right up to me. I had previously walked in there. I was debating on what tree to put my seat on. And I walked in this big circle, you know, and I came back and I said, I'll put it right here. And I sat down. That deer came up, got to where I walked, walking along, all of a sudden stood up, combed the whole area. And I was in camouflage and I just sat there and I didn't move. The wind was right in my face. I stayed still. I didn't move. And the deer looked around and followed, smelled where I walked.
And then realized, okay, I'm not around. I kept looking. It must have been 15 minutes looking for me. Couldn't find me. So it's okay. And it walked. It came closer and closer. And you're not going to believe this, and neither is anybody who's listening to this, but this is the God's honest truth. The deer came walking and walking. It walked by me. Walked by me from me to you away. Walked right by me. And I took my hand, and I slapped him in the ass.
I remember that story, yes.
That's a true story. Yeah. I slapped the deer in the ass, and Mama, tell you what, that deer took off running.
He finally found you.
He found me, that's right. But I didn't do it to a buck, it was a doe. And I said, boy, now that would have been great. It wasn't even hunting season, yeah. But I just wanted to go out there and see what I could see. So that was really amazing. I went to school on that because I had walked through that area hours before, and that deer still knew I was there.
That's amazing.
Their nose is unbelievable. You can't hide from their nose. Yeah. Can't do it.
So this is the camera. Photo camera?
Yeah, it takes shots at movement. And I told my hunting buddies, look, I'm going out there. I might as well put a camera out. Yeah. I was going to bring a couple cameras, but I'll just put the one out. I'm debating. I'm putting it here.
So how do you decide where to put it?
Well, I'm going to see. I'm going to go on the other side of the stand and see if there's more tracks on the other side, just to see.
So when will you come back to check it out? Or is it transmitted to you digitally?
No, this is one that's transmitted. I wish I did have one like that, but I'll come back. I try to keep my scent out of this area. Yeah. I'll come back probably late summer.
Oh, wow.
And I'll check it.
So it has a good battery.
Yeah, it's got 8 batteries in it. And I'll just... I'll check it late summer and see what I see. Maybe I'll move it to a different tree and check it again in the fall.
So, did you ever have any surprises on your cameras? Like, I don't know, some naked hiker or
no.
Some
no, I did. I did see once. I did see a guy sneaking on the property, but I couldn't see his face because the camera sits so low. I just saw it from his waist down walking through, and it wasn't one of my guys. Yeah. So yeah, let me just make sure it's on. There we go. Alrighty.
Oh, quite a bit of tracks.
Yeah. Yeah. They're working. You see, they're working east to west or west to east. Yeah. They're going from their bedding area we saw.
Yeah.
They come through here, feed what they can. I saw one of the biggest bucks I ever saw. See those posted signs up in there?
Yes.
I saw one of the big. I was in that stand that we walked by.
Yeah.
I watched this monster buck walking down through along the, and I said, oh my God, he's a big one. And I tried everything to get him to come my way. I mean everything. Nothing worked. Nothing worked.
So you deserve to live.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. There are times when you get tired and say, Jesus, I can't go out again. I can't go out again. Well, I look at it as the day you're so tired you don't want to go, that's the day the buck's going to walk right by your stand.
So you just always find motivation.
Yeah.
That was how it all started. And the beginning of your book is also starting in a certain way, which is with a chapter that is called Why We Bow Hunt.
Yeah.
That is how your book starts.
Yeah.
So what is the answer to that question or to that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different answers.
Yeah.
Some people bow hunt because they want to get out in the, they want to be out with nature when the weather's nice. Other people like a longer season so they can scout for a nice buck. Other people just want to get out there for the nature. Other people want to get out there for the meat. They get
Why with a bow?
Because that's the only season that's open at the time.
Okay.
And bow season, you don't find very many hunters out. Mm-hmm. There could be guys out, but you don't hear them. The bow doesn't make any noise, and you don't see them. Rarely do you run into another hunter out here, which is nice. You've got the whole, you feel like you've got the whole woods to yourself. And because I play a man of war, I basically do. I can go whatever else is working during the day. I can come out here and hunt. And
I think the reason is not only because it's like bow season gives you more flexibility. I think it's also because it's just a different kind of challenge, right? Hunting with a bow.
It's a huge challenge. People who don't think it's a challenge, they should take it up. It's a big challenge. It's a lot less of a challenge now today than it was when I started. Because when I started, they didn't even have compound bows at the time. It was just a recurve bow. That was it. The compound bows came out in the early 70s. And so, then everyone started hunting with a compound bow. So it got to be less of a challenge, but you still needed to know your distance that you could shoot comfortably. That may be 10 yards. I don't know what it is in meters.
No clue.
My range is about 40 yards. That's my range. I might be able to hit a deer in an open field past that, but I wouldn't in the woods because there's just too much little shit in the way. If your arrow hits anything, it's going to deflect, and you might wound the animal, and that's worse than anything, you know. So I wait until I have a good shot, and I know the deer's going to go down, you know. Other guys, it depends. You know, I've had guys that say, I can't shoot. If you can shoot a bullseye at 10 yards consistently, but at 15 yards you can't, well, then 10 yards is your limit. That's it. And then you've got to think ethically. That deer's out there 20 yards. I know I can hit him at 10. There's nobody here. I'm going to try it. Mm. That's when you make the mistake. If you're going to try it, now you're not thinking about the ethics of it all. What if you wound that animal? Chances are you will. And that animal has to go die someplace, a horrible death, you know, with an arrow stuck in him someplace. And, you know, and what happens is some other animal, coyotes around here, pick up on his scent. It's an awful way to go.
No.
It's an awful way to go. So, I try to explain that to people in classes all the time. You know, come on. A lot of this is you got to be ethical out there. You got to be ethical. Period.
Period. Over and out. With this statement and call for ethical hunting, the bonus part of this episode comes to an end. I thank all of you who made it this far for listening. Please consider subscribing to our show if you liked it. And of course, I especially thank Eric Adams for so generously taking the time to show me around and to give me and all of us these insights. Thank you very much. Take care and see you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.